Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Ohio is full of fascinating people. People whose passions infuse their careers or their hobbies, or sometimes both. This hour, we're introducing you to three fascinating Ohioans. And we begin with a hip-hop artist who's bringing the music form to his students. A native Ohioan who credits a high school class with sparking her interest in volcanoes and her career assessing activity levels. And finally, we're going to hear from an Ohio State football fan who continues a tradition begun by his father. But we start with the Ohio State's hip-hop professor, Jason Rawls. Welcome to All Sides.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I want to begin with the music that started it all.
Okay.
How did you first come to hip-hop?
Great question. Well, I grew up on the south side of Columbus, so I'm you know, part of that fabric when you think of Lockbourne and Freebus and Thurman, you know, with Donato's. You know, I grew up, like, Donato's was my local pizzeria before it became this big juggernaut, right? So, you know, I'm from that part of town, that side where, you know, working class, that kind of thing. And so when this music came, you know, we already had disco. We've got all these other different types of musics and that kind of thing. But when this music came that was kind of different and it had a different feel to it, we were like, this is cool. And I remember my dad saying when the Sugar Hill Gang Rapper's Delight came out, he said, son, this is a fad. OK, this is not going to last. Nobody's going to be listening to that. That's how he said it. He said, nobody's going to listen to that. And so it kept going, right? And so you get things in 81, you get Blondie with Rapture, you get Grandmaster Flash with The Message, and things keep going. And then in 84, there was a couple of movies that came out that just kind of changed everything. And I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but a movie called Breakin' and a movie called Beat Street. And when those came out, it brought hip-hop culture to the big screen. And so people, for the first time, are really seeing people break dance on screen and rapping and graffiti and all these things. And it captured our whole heart and mind and soul.
Yeah, I was born in 1983.
All right.
So I came to it a little bit later, sort of in the early 90s. And I would say I was always drawn to the lyricism and the social commentary. I grew up with people like Snoop Dogg and mm-hmm. Tupac, mm-hmm. Biggie, Nas, even some N.W.A., even okay. though it was like a little throwback right, by right. the time I was coming of age. And N.W.A. was incredibly political.
Mm-hmm.
They had biting commentary on power, policing, yes. the yes. war on drugs. I can't say the title on air,
yep.
but they have a blank the police song mm-hmm. that is probably their most famous and most controversial
sure,
lyrics.
Sure. I mean, at that time, the exciting thing about hip hop was that's the late 80s, or I call it the adolescence theme. And when I teach it in my class, that's kind of how we talk about it, because hip hop, they give it the birthday to 1973, but it's from the early 70s, right? South Bronx, New York City. And it's kind of growing. By the time the 80s hit, when Run-DMC really started to come out in 83, 85, it was still braggadocio lyrics. Like, hey, we're rapping about, you know, this is my Adidas. These are the kind of clothes I wear. You know, I'm the best rapper, all that kind of thing.
This is like LL Cool J era.
Yeah, right? All that good era, right? And then so what starts to happen is people start to notice things going on in their communities and they start to say something about it. Well, how do you say something about it? Well, I use the medium that I know. And right now we rap. We do hip hop. And so hip hop becomes this voice for the voiceless. It becomes this voice for the community where people are like, hey, this is going on in our communities and we're going to talk about it. And this is going on in that. And so that kind of changed the game. It kind of opened everything up. And of course it was vulgar, you know, it was all that kind of language. And I
couldn't even find a clip.
Yeah, no, you're not. Yeah, no. But, you know, but they still had something to say. And I think that's the important thing to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, radio stations wouldn't play it.
Sure.
There were even questions about whether it was music at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then today, 50 years later, Snoop Dogg and Martha Stewart wore matching outfits to watch dressage at the Olympics.
Yeah. How times have changed. In my class, I show students the time when Snoop Dogg was on trial for murder. Like, there was a time when if you said Snoop Dogg, that was like the worst. It's like Tupac. It's like, oh, it's that vulgar hip hop, that language. Oh, it's the worst thing. Gangster rap. That was the term. No more gangster rap. No more. And so you hear all these things, and now to look at how it's changed, it really says something about our society, about how hip-hop has permeated pop culture, how now hip-hop is just a part of the fabric of everyone's everyday life.
Yeah, my mom loved seeing Snoop Dogg and Martha Stewart together. She was like, look at their outfits. And said, I had to, as a child of the early 90s,
had
go
to remind her.
I was like, do you remember banning me from playing his music or even buying his CDs?
What'd
like,
she
do
say?
You recall
did she,
that?
Did she recall? Did she say?
She's like, she had cognitive, she forgot, she conveniently, I'm using air quotes here, forgot about how controversial he was 30 years prior.
Was he that bad? I don't remember.
But he seems so nice. And right. It's like, oh, okay.
Okay.
clearly, there's a lot of history and context around hip hop, particularly mm-hmm. as an agent of political change.
Sure.
I mean, we talked about NWA, some of their lyrics. That was coming out at a time. So I was, you know, in an upper middle class suburb of New York. Mm-hmm. And they weren't reflecting my life,
sure.
these stories, but they were exposing me to the idea that my experience was not universal, which I also think is incredibly important.
Sure, I agree.
And it was also coming at the time of Rodney King.
Mm.
And as much as we talk about Black Lives Matter now, mm-hmm. I mean, this is an issue that hip-hop artists have been singing about for 40 years.
Correct, because it hasn't changed as much. And that's the thing, you know, that's what makes hip-hop music so powerful and the culture so powerful, because it gives a voice to the voiceless. I think I mentioned that before, but that's so important, because here's the thing. That song about the police, we can't say the title. That song about the police by NWA came out in 1988. It was probably recorded in 87, right? And so that lets you know these things have been going on, because Rodney King didn't happen until about 91. Right. So there's that whole, and you got to understand, and Ice-T had with his heavy metal rock band, because it wasn't a hip hop song. He gets credited for that, but it was not a hip hop song. He had that song called Cop Killer. Right. And so people are telling you something's wrong. Something's going on. And so that's the thing. I think we should use that music as culture and to listen to see what's going on.
So let's talk about the process of creating this curriculum. Mm. What was the reaction from the administration when you were like, I want to teach a class about hip hop?
Well, I'll tell you the honest to goodness truth. I have been doing this for years and years. I actually have about 17 years of K-12 experience, and I taught at Columbus City Schools for the majority of that time. And as I was doing that, I was also a world touring DJ and producer of hip hop. So I've been doing this, and I've been blessed to work with, you know, Beastie Boys, Talib Kweli, Mos Def. And so a lot of hip hop artists. And so what I had thought about was, in my classrooms, I was noticing that I was having really good relationships with my students, you know, and I'm doing air quotes here, the bad kids, right? Teachers would send the bad kids down to my classroom, and I could relate to them. And what I realized was, it was through hip hop culture that we were relating, and I was meeting them where they were. And so as I was doing that, I realized, wow, what can we do in education to change education a little bit, to kind of use this culture? And so I started doing that, and I started adding it in, and I told schools all around Central Ohio, higher education schools, and I was told, nah, that wouldn't work. I don't think that's a good idea. We don't know, blah, blah, blah. And so fast forward, I got an opportunity in about 2011 to teach hip hop at Tiffin University. And once I started doing that, I realized there's a couple of different notions, because I was teaching it in education, but you can also teach it in the School of Music.
Yeah.
And it was exciting to realize that as a culture, this isn't being taught in the School of Music in 2011. And so I kept trying to bring it to different schools. Eventually, I got an opportunity to teach a class here in 2019 at The Ohio State University. And did it through the Department of African American and African Studies. And I brought the class to Ohio State in 2019. We had 20 students enrolled. And after we taught that class and I brought that curriculum, word of mouth, students just started talking. And now I'm actually now an assistant professor of hip hop here at The Ohio State University.
Is that strange to see that business card?
It's hugely strange. I'm like, wait a minute, is that's real? That's me? OMG.
Is that's what's on your door, too, yes, to your office, professor of hip hop.
It is on my door. And imagine that back when your mom was telling you couldn't listen to Snoop. That wouldn't even have been fathomable.
Do you hope to expand the program here at Ohio State?
We are actually doing that now. We're working to expand it into a minor program. We're writing curriculum and writing courses as we speak to add them to the School of Music and the Department of African American and African Studies.
You also include breakdancing and graffiti, including yes, inviting your students to learn a little bit about how to do these moves.
Correct, because that's a part of the culture. Hip hop has four main elements, and that is graffiti, b-boying, or what everybody knows is breakdancing, DJing, and then emceeing or rapping. And so most people know the rapping part. That's kind of like the easy part.
Yeah.
Right? But they don't quite understand the rest of the culture that surrounds it. And so sharing that with students usually opens their eyes and makes them so much more interested.
Yeah, graffiti is its own artistry.
Definitely, definitely. And has its own culture. Just like b-boying has its own culture, own terminology, own vernacular, own customs, everything. They all do.
But they all come together under this umbrella of hip-hop.
Correct, of hip-hop. Yep, that's it.
Do you discuss at all how it's changed? I'm sure there are modern critiques, right, that it sure is too commercialized,
mm-hmm,
too part of the culture.
Yes, there definitely is. There's a lot. There's hip hop purists who kind of feel like, hey, you know, we shouldn't, you know, put it out there like that. There's people that feel like it should be. There's people that say, hey, it is too commercialized. The thing about it is hip hop is here and it's here to stay. And so, to me, it's important to educate people about the culture of hip hop and to teach them the origin and to teach them where it came from and why it happened. You know, hip hop was born out of socioeconomic stress and people dealing, and they had creative abilities that they wanted to express, but didn't have the resources or the money or what have you to make these things happen. So they created a way. And I think that's important to share with young people.
I also think it's indicative of African-American music more generally.
Mm.
It seems as though it's always been pushed to the side,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and had to fight its way into culture.
I think you're right. You know, you look at jazz, you look at blues, you look at rock and roll. You know, rock and roll started as black music. And it's not unknown or unheard of to have that happen. People call it the whitewashing of music or something like that. But the thing is, I think it's great when other cultures or other ethnicities get into any type of music, because what it shows is kind of like what I think you learned when you were growing up is, hey, there's another side of the world. There's people live yeah differently. And this happens over here. And that's OK. Being diverse is not a bad thing. Like to see how people do things and how they live differently. That's a good thing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up listening to Sublime, Beastie Boys, mm-hmm, Eminem. Like, mm-hmm, there's lots of people who have done really incredible things with the genre.
Definitely, definitely. And that's the thing. The thing about hip hop is it doesn't really matter if you're black or white or Asian or what have you. As long as you're hip hop, you're accepted. That's what we're looking for. It's the culture.
So you've also released solo albums,
yes,
and founded a production company here in Columbus.
Yes, yes. Polar Entertainment is my company. And I produce and I also do education, right? So I do PDs, professional developments for educators who want to try to learn how to bring hip hop into their classroom, that kind of thing. So I'm everywhere. I'm trying to do everything.
You're the professor of hip hop. I want to play a clip, actually, from when you performed in September on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon.
Okay.
Performing Native Sons from their new album, The Confidence of Knowing, with a little help from The Roots. Give it up for Talib Kweli and J. Rawls.
Tonight Show, make some noise. Talib Kweli. My name is J. Rawls. Let's go.
Can witnessing the hip-hop apocalypse. If you ain't got the bars, I promise it's looking ominous. So yeah, let's get it going, let's get provocative. In Brooklyn, who's stopping us? We are the true conquerors.
Do your students ever come to you and say, hey, I listen to you?
All the time. All the time.
Is that strange?
It used to be. Now I'm getting used to it. But the cool thing is I never tell my students what I do or anything like that. I just teach.
They find it on their own.
They find it on their own. And then word starts to spread. And I like it like that because I approach them with, hey, this is a class. I need you to be here. I need you to, you know, be attentive. And, oh, yeah, by the way, you know, I was on Jimmy Fallon.
I think that just gives you cool points with kids.
Probably.
Have you ever thought about a class about the intersection of like politics and protest movements in hip hop or music and protest?
Oh, most definitely. And that's part of what we're writing. My colleague, Stevie Johnson, Dr. View, and I are creating this program. And so we're trying to come up with all kinds of different aspects. You know, we're talking about hip hop in society, right? Misogyny, you know, gender, all that. We want to talk about everything when we talk about hip hop because it's all encompassing.
Well, when you get that created, I get to audit classes for free as an employee of Ohio State. I might have to check it out. I really love it.
That would be great. Come hang.
I don't know that I'll try dancing, though. That's where I draw the
line. That'll be fun.
That was Jason Rawls, hey. Professor of Hip Hop at The Ohio State University. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Coming up, how a lesson about volcanoes sparked a lifelong passion. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Laura Clore knew nothing about geology until a class in Mount Vernon High School sparked her interest. The Ohio native can draw a straight line from that ninth grade class to the work she does today. She's a geochemist with the U.S. Geological Survey based at the Cascades Volcano Observatory in Vancouver, Washington. And she joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Laura.
Hi, Anna. Thanks for having me.
I love this idea that one class changed the trajectory of the rest of your life. Can you take us back to that moment in high school? What was it that captured your imagination?
I really do see it that way. To back up even a little bit from there, I was always as a kid interested in nature and had just a fascination with the natural world. My favorite classes were all the science classes. As a younger kid, I loved the way they could help me understand how the world works. And so I arrived in high school, I had the opportunity to take a geology class, which is something I knew nothing about before that, except I would like collect rocks as a kid, like every kid does, but I knew nothing about them. And I thought, you know, here's this opportunity to learn about something I didn't know. And I walked into this geology class and I was just fascinated from day one. The teacher was really dynamic and wonderful. And he brought to me this topic I didn't even know before this that you could think about, like, you know, why does the landscape look the way it does? And that just hooked me right from the start.
You didn't settle on volcanoes right away, but how did they end up being your focus?
I realized that I loved thinking about volcanoes because, a lot of what we think about in geology and, this is important work, but a lot of it is thinking about the deep, deep geologic past, and all of that sets an important foundation for what we know in geology. But I really was motivated to learn about, you know, processes that I could see with my eyes, things that were happening on timescales that a human can understand. And volcanoes are something that do that. They're happening. We can see them. They are creating, they're changing the landscape in a way that we can see. And I loved that.
Yeah, I think if any of us know anything about famous eruptions, we've probably heard of Pompeii.
But, yes, that's right. Well-known one.
Yeah. Or the one where you are up in Washington, when Mount St. Helens. Yes.
That's right. That's right. You're referring to the Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980. Very famous. It is the event that created the office where I work now. There wasn't an observatory here before that event. And then after that happened, it was obvious that we needed to have some sort of agency here that would be able to monitor the volcanoes in this region, which is what we do now.
Yeah, Mount Hood in Oregon, the Three Sisters. I used to live out in Oregon, so I just know the names, like Shasta, all
yes.
of this Cascade Range. They're volcanoes.
They are. They are. When you are, if you are visiting the Pacific Northwest, like Portland, Oregon, or Seattle, you look out on the horizon, you see peaks, and for the most part, those are all volcanoes.
Yeah, there are about 170 potentially active volcanoes in the United States. How does one define potentially active?
Well, these are volcanoes that have had activity recently enough that it's conceivable they could erupt again. And when geologists talk about volcanoes that could be active, we're not using really the same language that, you know, a layperson might use to think about an active volcano. We're thinking about, you know, a volcano might have erupted thousands of years ago, but if that is sort of its typical cycle that it's had in the past, we would still consider that to be active.
How do you know it erupted thousands of years ago?
Well, this isn't my particular specialty, but we do have experts here at the observatory who go out and collect rocks that were deposited by past eruptions. And those are kind of like the history book that tells the story of what that volcano has done in the past. And they can map out eruptions that it had in the distant past by studying those rocks.
Your work involves monitoring the gas levels at volcanoes to determine their activity. Can you describe a little bit about how that works?
Right. So there are three main components to, I'm just going to back up a tiny bit. There are three Sure. main components to monitoring a volcano. We like to refer to it as the three-legged stool of volcano monitoring. And those are seismicity, so monitoring the earthquakes, the ground shaking that happens when magma is making its way to the surface. The next piece is something we call ground deformation, which is when you can think of it like ground swelling if magma is moving up from below. And we monitor that with, you know, very sensitive GPS, like you have in your phone, only way more sensitive than that. And then the third leg of this stool, and my personal favorite, is the gases that come out of volcanoes. And those give us basically a window down into the magma chamber to see what's happening down there. The gases relate directly to the amount of magma that's down there, how deep it is, if it's moving, and if any of these things change, the gases can send us a signal up here at the surface.
So I've seen photos of you at the summit of Mount Hood in Oregon collecting samples for volcano monitoring. Is everything looking okay over there as ski season comes around?
Yes, we collect samples from close to the summit of Mount Hood every year. Of the gases, which tell us, we do it annually because we want to see the kind of baseline composition
yeah.
of the gases coming out of this volcano. And
yeah.
It's chugging along at kind of a baseline background value that is not concerning to us at all.
You also were in Hawaii during the emergency response to the eruption in 2022. What was that like?
Yes, this was the long-awaited eruption of Mauna Loa volcano, which hadn't erupted since 1984. And it was a very big deal because in the past, some eruptions of Mauna Loa have happened in such a way that lava flows went very quickly toward populated areas. So there was a huge concern that when it erupted again, it could potentially do that. And in this case, just fortuitously, the way the eruption unfolded, it didn't go toward it. It did kind of the best possible scenario. It went toward unpopulated areas and was over pretty quickly and didn't cause that much damage. But I went over to assist the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory when there's a big volcanic event like that. Our sister observatories. There are five different observatories in the US, actually. And when one of them has a big event, they reach out to the other ones and get help. And so I went over to help make measurements of the gases that were being emitted by Mauna Loa, which helped us understand how the eruption was unfolding.
What are there US volcanoes on a watch list? I don't know if that's the right way to conceive about it, of it, but do you like categorize them into like high risk, medium risk, low risk?
Yes, that's exactly how we categorize it.
Oh,
We
good.
have we have very high threat is the top level of that, and then it goes to high threat and medium and down from there. And those categories are defined both by the volcano's history and how often it erupts and how likely it is to erupt again, and the style of its eruption, like is it explosive? Does it have particularly dangerous kinds of eruptions? So those things are taken into account, but also its proximity to populations of people. So for example, Mount Rainier is a very high threat volcano. If it erupted, it would be very, very hazardous and dangerous to like the entire Seattle region.
Yeah, Mount Hood is set a little ways away from Portland, so it is probably not as high risk.
It is also categorized as a very high
Oh,
threat
okay.
volcano. It erupted not that long ago. I don't have the number right in my head, but late 1700s, I think,
I like that
from the
not that long
geological
ago is
record.
late 1700s.
See, I'm talking like a geologist.
I love it.
And it sent pyroclastic flows, which are hot flows of ash and rock. Down its slopes into areas that are today populated by lots of people.
Well, I'm glad you're keeping an eye on it.
Yes, that's right.
I wonder, have you ever circled back with your geology teacher? Does I don't he, she know what you do now? He.
Yes, I would like to give a quick shout out to John Fry from Mount Vernon High School. Thank you so much for bringing me this line of work because I feel like he really set the course for the rest of my life. I don't know, maybe I would have gotten here otherwise, but this de is definitely it set the line that I took. And yeah, I see him every now and then. My family is still back in Ohio, and I go visit at least every year, and I catch up with him from time to time. And I was out in I was somewhere. And brought him back a souvenir rock sample one time from some work I did. So
Oh, that's
I
cool.
definitely try to catch up with him now and then.
You must have quite the rock collection.
I used to, but I was before I got this job here at the Cascades Observatory, I was moving a lot and I had jobs in lots of different places. I was trying out work in lots of, I worked at the other observatories before here, and I was moving a lot and I just couldn't cart my rocks around all the
They weigh
time.
a
So
lot.
yeah, so I, kind of bequeathed them to other geologists. They went to good homes.
Have to think that your job also requires a certain level of physical fitness. I mean, summiting Mount Hood, well, you could probably drive most of the way, but like some of this monitoring probably requires a decent amount of hiking.
It It can. We do field work, and you know that's my favorite part of this job is being able to do the field work. It's what drew me to geology so much was that lots of it takes place outside. But I where our field work ranges from someplace that we can drive straight to and go collect a sample to places we need to hike long distances, maybe even backpack to get into. But there are also some areas that are so remote that we access them by helicopter, such as when we go to work in the sometimes I work in the crater of Mount St. Helens, which is our most recently active volcano in the Cascades. So it's the one we keep the strongest eye on. And I go collect gas samples from inside the crater there, once a year or so,
Oh my
and
gosh,
we
is
get
that
in
like
there
being
by
on the surface of the
helicopter.
moon? Like just
Kind
being
of,
down
yeah.
inside that crater?
That's right. It if for people who remember in 1980, it blew out the side of the volcano. So when you stand there in the crater, you're kind of in the guts of what used to be, the middle of the volcano, just looking out through this breached open side.
Yeah, it's wild.
That's
You should,
a
if
very
you've never seen it,
place
Google
to
a
be.
picture of it.
Yes,
Yeah.
exactly.
Yeah, but I was thinking even in the Cascade Range, like Mount Jefferson, the only way up is hiking. And that's not an easy hike from somebody who's done it.
No, yes. Yeah, the volcanoes tend to be tall and steep, and the for what I do, the gases often tend to be close to where the place where they come out tends to be close to the top, so we have to get ourselves up there one way or another.
Do you ever have to do any drilling to get them, or is it just it's venting, literally?
It's venting through some sort of it's established some kind of pathway to the surface, and we make use of that to collect our samples.
Are they dangerous at all? I just sort of wonder if the vent is really hot.
They sure can be. Fortunately, the places where I mostly work are not as hot as they could be. They are only boiling temperature, which is plenty hot enough to hurt yourself, but more active volcanoes than what we have in the Cascades can have gas vents that are hundreds of degrees. And I fortunately don't work very often with things like that, but the gases I collect are somewhere around boiling temperature, so we definitely need to take precautions to protect ourselves.
I would say then, like protective gear for sure.
Right. And I'm usually wearing a gas mask because the gases aren't very healthy to breathe. They can be
Oh,
toxic.
yeah. I've heard about that when the volcanoes erupt, too, the danger of that stuff releasing into the atmosphere.
Right. It can so at Hawaii, for example, when those volcanoes erupt, those gases are released near where people live, and they can be quite toxic, and they really impact air quality and of the communities living downwind from that.
That was Laura Klor, a geochemist with the U.S. Geological Survey based at the Cascades Volcano Observatory in Vancouver. Thank you so much. This was so fascinating.
Well, thank you for reaching out, Anna. Thanks.
Coming up, an Ohio State football fan who's carrying on a Buckeye tradition started by his father. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day,
we are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. If you've ever attended a football game at Ohio State, you might have met our next guest. He's one of the Redcoats, assisting attendees by scanning tickets or helping them find their seats. He's also carrying an Ohio State cooler that carries on a tradition started by his father. Doug Malone is a lifelong Ohio State football fan and Granville resident who was recently profiled by the reporting project at Denison University. Doug, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, Anna.
So you do more than check tickets of Ohio State fans. In some cases, you hand them a Buckeye. Where did that tradition start?
Well, my earliest recollection was 2005. It was before the Texas game, so it was a night game. And as you may know, night games at the Horseshoe can be somewhat electric.
Oh my gosh, I went to one earlier this season. Against, it was Marshall, right? Yeah, it was so good.
Yeah, yeah. And but anyway, Dad and I, we were walking towards our gates. We had just got there. We had checked in, and Dad worked, of course, worked at the North Rotunda, and I work one of the little side gates, and still work at
checking
the same
tickets,
gate.
Checking tickets, helping people out.
Helping people out, that kind of thing. And we were just conversing on our way to our assigned areas when one of the equipment managers popped out of the locker room. And he said that Coach Fickell needed a Buckeye. He liked to keep a Buckeye in his pocket for good luck. And at that time, Luke Fickell was our defensive coordinator. And Dad always happened to have one Buckeye. And he sent it back. And then as we were walking toward our gates, he came up with the idea that, you know, he had always indicated in the past that he had seen the team come through and nobody really did anything, and he felt the need to do something. And that gave him an epiphany of sorts, and that's when he decided to do it. And, you know, he was pretty dedicated to it. You know, he'd go to local parks and pick up Buckeyes, but he went through the proper channels, and the Red Coat Administration approved, and that's how it all got started. But yeah, it all started with a single Buckeye, and it's still pretty surreal to me when I think about it.
Yeah, so he got a cooler, he filled it with a couple hundred Buckeyes,
right,
and then he started handing them out to players, to coaches, to kids, to first-time attendees.
Right, yep.
How does he, or I guess how now, do you decide who gets a Buckeye? Who is Buckeye worthy?
Well, I think everybody's Buckeye worthy that shows up on game day. And we you know, as a red coat, we do everything we can to make sure everybody has a top-notch experience, because we know it's a kind of a mecca destination for college football fans. But my typical day, I typically start out by checking in at my side gate. I still work at that same side gate that I
what
start.
What gate is it?
Gate 18.
There you go.
So if you're ever at Ohio Stadium and you'd like a Buckeye, come on through. I'd be happy to give one to you. You too, Anna, if you ever come through.
Oh, you just gave me one. It's
that's
amazing.
Right. Yeah.
It's got a little message on it. Not all of them get messages.
No. Oh, no. We tried to tag all of them. My daughters came up with that idea a couple of years ago, and they thought it would be a good idea to add messages to them. And so we typically stay with the Go Bucks, you know, OHIO,
and
slogans. Ohio Against the World,
which is the one I'm looking at right now.
That's right. Those are our coaches' Buckeyes.
Oh, so yeah. You have to be a coach to get the Ohio Against the World Buckeye?
No, you don't.
Ah, obviously, because I'm holding one and I am not a football coach. So I love that the different coaches over the years have different approaches to this. So Jim Tressel didn't take Buckeyes.
Right. And an interesting story about that. Now, Dad was handing them out at the time, and funny story Dad always liked to tell was that he actually would watch Tressel walk by, and he never took one. Dad never really said anything. About the third or fourth week into the season, Dad asked him if he would like a Buckeye, and Coach Tressel stopped, and he pointed behind him and said, "I've got all my lucky Buckeyes behind me."
But Urban Meyer took them.
Urban Meyer did take him. Yes, he did. And I remember one year for the Michigan game, Dad brought a Buckeye necklace with him, and Urban wore it into the stadium. So that was kind of neat.
Oh, that is cool. And then was your dad around for Ryan Day or no?
He was. No.
Yeah, I was thinking timeline-wise,
no,
probably
he was not. So the last game,
Ryan Day was there. He just wasn't head coach yet.
Right. He was offensive coordinator.
So your dad may have actually given him a Buckeye, just not as head coach.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. He gave him a Buckeye.
Yeah. So your father passed away in 2016. And one of the things I thought was so incredibly sweet was that Urban Meyer and some of the other players came to visit him when he was battling cancer.
Yes. So dad was in the James, and my family and I were on vacation, and my mom got a hold of me and told me that my niece had sent a tweet out to the Buckeye team letting them know that dad was in the hospital. And so they heard back from Austin Mack, who was a freshman wide receiver at the time. And he said, well, he asked how long dad was going to be there because they, you know, they were going to be able to stop by in maybe 2 days or so, 2 days from that point. And they said, yeah, you know, he'll be there. And so, you know, mom let my family and I know, and she, you know, got a hold of my siblings. And so we left our vacation early and came back and, you know, nobody told them. So they wanted it to be a surprise.
Oh, my goodness.
And, of course, we had dad had a Sporting News sitting out there, and it was the college football edition. And he was kind of thumbing through that, and then all of a sudden the door opens, and here comes Austin Mack and Urban Meyer, you know, into the room. And it was a pretty surreal experience. They spent about, I would say, a good 15 to 20 minutes visiting, but it was an unscheduled stop. The nurses told us it was an unscheduled stop, and it was something he wanted to do. So that, you know, that was real special. And at the time he spent with dad, and dad had a really good day that day. So that was pretty awesome.
What was the last game that your father handed out Buckeyes for?
So the last game dad was there for was 2015. It was the 2015 Michigan State game when they won on that last-second field goal.
So oh, my goodness. Yeah. That's a heck of a game.
Yeah, and I remember that day very well because dad wasn't he wasn't moving around so well. He wasn't doing so well at this time. And we never – I can't say that we had a real direct conversation about me taking over to pass out Buckeyes because it – That's not how our family operated, because we always believed that, you know, I believed he was going to beat it. He believed he was going to beat it still, and he was going to be there the following year. So, but he did pull me aside when he was there because it wasn't a good day for him health wise, and he showed me where I needed to stand. And there's a mark at the North Rotunda, and he pointed to that, and he's like, Doug, this is where I stand. But yeah, like I said, we didn't have a direct conversation, but I knew what he was insinuating, and I tried to just play off of it. I didn't want to go down that road just yet because I wasn't ready to give up either. But yeah, that's what happened. I remember him leaving early that game, and I was going to get up and leave with him because it was halfway through the game. It was a pretty close game, of course, but he insisted that I stay. He didn't want me to go back. And, you know, thinking back, I kind of wish I probably would have, you know, if I had to do over again, I probably would have walked back with him, but I stayed. I didn't want to, you know.
It was a good game.
It was a good game till the end.
Yeah. And, so did he end up seeing them win the national championship?
In 2014?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so he made it through that. And then he passed away in 2016.
Passed away in 2016, yep.
And that fall, you took over the tradition.
That fall, I took over the tradition. And we actually lost him in September of 2016. So we had a home game a few days later. And, boy, that was...
That was hard, yeah. I have to think.
Tough day. So that was like my second game, I think, and boy, tears were streaming down my face. I had my sunglasses on, but tears were streaming, and it was pretty emotional that day, but, you know, we got through it.
Did the team know that he'd passed by that point?
Well, Coach Fickell stopped because he and
Dad— The guy that
Dad,
started it all.
He kind of started it all, but he and Dad over the years created a bond. They had a pretty good bond together, and— You know, so he, as he was walking through, he saw me, and then he asked how Dad was doing, and I was like, oh, you know. And so he kind of put his arm around me, and I walked with him for a little while, and, you know, and then finished handing out the Buckeyes. But that was, you know, that was a really neat moment, because at that point, that's how I, you know, I saw how Dad touched other people, and I just got it in my head that I'm going to do the same now.
Is it the same cooler? Or has it updated over the years?
Actually, I have Dad's cooler at home. This is a new and improved, believe it or not. It's a little bit bigger. Dad's was kind of tiny. It was still an Ohio State cooler, but
this is bigger and better.
Yeah, bigger and better. And since that time, we've made a few distinct changes to the tradition. Like, I think Dad was a little more picky about the Buckeyes than I am, because he didn't like the flat ones. I like the flat ones because my daughters always liked the flat ones growing up, and you know,
they'd be easier to stick messages on.
They're easier to stick messages on. And that's one thing. Dad's Buckeyes didn't have messages, but my daughters came up with that idea and felt like we should have them. But I told them, once we come up with that idea and we do it, we're kind of stuck with it.
That's a lot of writing.
Yes. So now my help sometimes kind of ventures off. So now sometimes it's just me doing it. So I got to make sure I write neatly so it reads Go Bucks and maybe not Go Backs, right? So my U's have a tendency to look like A's at times, so...
Do people ever donate Buckeyes to you?
Yes, I'm very fortunate in that regard. And with me, you know, Dad went out and collected Buckeyes on his own a lot. And he had a couple of guys at the North Rotunda that would bring some in for him as well. A couple of other Redcoats. And fortunately, one of the Redcoats is still there, and he brings them in for me quite a bit. Now, that first year was kind of a challenge for me because I was kind of scrambling. You know, I was doing good. If I had like 120, I knew I needed at least 126 for the team, coaches, walk-ons, all that. So that was always my goal. But now I don't have to worry about that as much thanks to a lot of the other people. There's a couple that sell Buckeye necklaces on the corner of Lane and Ohentangy across from the shot. And they bring a bag of Buckeyes for me every week.
Aww.
And of course, my buddy, my friend, who's a Redcoat at the North Rotunda, he brings quite a few. And, you know, he supplies those coaches' Buckeyes as well. They come from Indian Lake.
They're bigger, aren't they?
They're just a little bit bigger, a little bit different. I still haven't found out where that tree is yet, though. They won't tell me. I've been asking, but...
Oh my gosh, they're secretive about the big Buckeye tree.
They're very secretive about it, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard Ryan Day was a little surprised at how big you can get them.
Yeah, you know, I mean, really, when they come through the rotunda, it's very businesslike. And
yeah.
It's, you know, it goes by really quick, but... I have heard him say, like, wow, that's a big one. You know? So that part of it's kind of neat, you know. And
do you know what happens to them? Like, what do they do with them?
Well, they asked him last year in one of his press conferences. He says he hangs on to them, but I know that some of them will go through and they'll give them to kids that are lined up, like, as they walk down the ramp and onto the field. So what they do is they come from the pep rally about 2 hours before game time. And then they're all walking over. This year, they're wearing sweats instead of suits. So they, you know, most of them have their headphones on. But it happens really super fast. I mean, to me, it feels like it's super fast anyway. But yeah, they'll hand them out to kids, and I guess that's part of the paying it forward.
Yeah. You ever thought about how many Buckeyes are in people's homes from you and your dad?
I have thought about it, and it's pretty neat. You know, you know.
Like, this one's absolutely going up on my little shelf in my office here.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah.
I'm definitely going to hold on to it.
You know, and Dad always said he wanted to leave his mark, and I think he did that. And I think his legacy, more than anything else, is just bringing people together. And I see that in my everyday life, but I especially see it on game days at the Shoe. It is so much fun to see. Like, me personally, I have... people that I grew up with, people that I work with, that'll come to the games and kind of look me up. And it's you know, I look forward to that more than anything else, you know. And, of course, the fans, too, that are coming in, because I get a kick out of the – I can always spot a first-timer because they'll walk in. And I've seen grown men cry when they enter the Shoe. You know, it's pretty amazing. But one of the funny stories I have is that there was once a guy that came in, a fan that came in and asked if he could have a Buckeye. So I gave him a Buckeye, And he popped it in his mouth.
And
I was like, oh, sir, they're poisonous. You know, you don't want to eat those ones, you know.
No, it's not the chocolate and peanut butter ones.
Oh, right. Exactly.
That was Doug Malone, a lifelong Ohio State football fan who will be handing out Buckeyes at Gate 18 for the foreseeable future. Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me. Stop by and see me.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides, right here on 89.7 NPR News.